I'm Darius Larson from St. Cloud and the village philosopher here this week, which means I'm the person who helps facilitate or tries to facilitate these forums. Forums are a place and an opportunity for you to share input with each other about a whole host of topics. Today's topic is Close Encounters of a Feminist Spine. And I overheard two comments already today, just kind of eavesdropping. One was, oh, thank God we're going to talk about that topic here at Holden. And the other was, isn't that a contradiction in terms? And I thought that was interesting. Spread already. To do that, it was suggested that we have a variety of people share some brief stories of how they have encountered feminism and or feminists in their own lives and tell a little story about that. And there are six of them. It will take a little bit of time, but I think that's part of the sharing. And we've asked Susan to go first.
My name is Susan Burkolo, and for the last 4 years, I've been parish pastor of an inner city congregation in Los Angeles, California. I have been and done other things as well. Being a parish pastor was never my goal in life. Growing up in a church that still does not ordain women, it was never presented to me as a model. And my life has pretty much been a journey of discovering sort of who I am and learning to identify or define myself with the help of many other people. Some very wonderful men and women in my life have helped me to feel free enough to become the person I am today, which is the same and different than I was some years ago. And also some encounters with some very unpleasant encounters have also helped me to become the person I am today and helped me to sharpen my focus and to feel affirmed, I think, in what I'm doing. In terms of talking about feminism today, we talked about this last week. Some had some very good discussions that were reflected a variety of opinions. And what I just really like to do today is share a little bit of the fact that for me, feminism is something of a journey. It's not that at some point in my life I said, okay, here I'm a feminist and I changed. I'm still on a journey of discovering who I am. And there are many incidents that occur in life that help me to clarify that. And I just wanted to share one with you this evening that, you know how you have experiences with people and you remember these and you think about them later. Sometimes it's what I wish I had said or what I wish I hadn't said or sometimes it's just something that becomes clearer to you for the first time. The particular experience I'm thinking of happened a couple of years ago. I was home on a Saturday morning working on a sermon, and the doorbell rang. I went there. This couple, very well-dressed, who spoke Spanish, as do about 85% of my neighborhood. And I pretty much suspected also who they were on a Saturday morning at that hour. And I just sort of thought that I would keep this conversation short to get on, because I knew there was not much point in dialogue in this case. And the first thing they asked me, though, when I opened the door was, are you aware that there are some churches that are in the truth and some that are not? And I thought, well, that's an easy enough question. I'll just take care of this and get on with my life. And I said, yes, I was aware that that was true. And I just said, well, but I really don't care to discuss this much further with you. I'm the pastor of the church down the street. And the next question I received before this conversation closed was from this man who did most of the talking, who said, but haven't you read in the Bible where it says that women should keep silent in church? And I figured I really couldn't let that go by. And so we spent some time there at the door talking about this. And I explained very passionately to this couple what it meant to me to feel called by God to a vocation, what it meant to me to be called to that vocation, and how it also felt to have people try to deny that call on the basis of something other than the Spirit's gifts or ministry. And it was probably a much better sermon than the one I had on Sunday, but and really didn't seem to impress them very much either. But as I talked about that too, I clarified them that for me, I was very much aware there were some churches in the truth and some that were not. And for me, a church that was not in the truth is one that takes certain words in the Bible and uses them to distort the word, that gospel message of freedom and wholeness and healing and reconciliation and dignity for all people, and to use those words to distort the word, and especially to apply that to the oppression or exclusion of a particular group of people, whether it be women or blacks or gays or whatever group you particularly care to exclude, or whether that be also through justifying favored institutions such as apartheid or some kind of national dominance, one country over another. I said, definitely there are churches that are not in the truth, and I have experienced that. And then out of curiosity, I really asked them, what do you make of Galatians 3, where it says, for as many of you as were baptized into Christ to put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And I thought, they take the Bible literally. They must understand this somehow. And this man said to me, well, of course, that's the way it's going to be in the kingdom of God, but not now.
Right.
and that this light bulb went on inside of me that said, aha, you know, there's something going on here. And my whole vision of the church, what it means to be the church in a broken world, what it means to be the church in an imperfect world, is something we were talking about last week in the Bible study, where this little bubble, we are a foretaste of the kingdom to come. We fulfill in a small, imperfect way those visions of abundant life for all, of a vision of a peaceful world where the lion and the lamb lie down together, where there is enough for all to eat, and where human beings love others as much as they love themselves. And this image just overwhelmed me a little bit. It's what it means for us to be the church today, to be a sign of the kingdom to come. And also, as we look at the Lord's Prayer today, this week I've been thinking about, it came to me also, how do we pray your kingdom come, Lord? Is it your kingdom come but not yet? Or your kingdom come but not this part of the kingdom because I'm not ready for it? The qualifiers we put on our prayers in excluding God from what we do. And I'm constantly reminded, do I qualify my prayers as well? And for me it served as a very good model of affirming what I felt my vocation to be, but also caused me to look at my own qualifiers and to be careful.
Margot?
I'm Margot Gordon, and I'm a professor at Northwestern University and in the Medill School of Journalism there, and also the director of a social science research center. As part of my work there, I got involved in a big research project on fear of crime, and as a spin-off of that, a project on fear of rape, more specifically. And some of you heard me talk about that yesterday. But I think that my real commitment to a feminist way of looking at things grew out of that project together with some other personal experiences I'd had. And it first elevated my own fear to find out how many other women in the world are afraid and of the things about which they're afraid. With this theme being gentle justice, I keep thinking about how these issues are not gentle and they're not just. And there's almost, it seems very difficult to connect them in a way. But as I thought about it, I became more involved because the violence I was thinking about was violence inside and outside people's homes by strangers and by people that women usually trust. And then if you think more about it, you think about how women are raised, and they're not helped to deal with this threat of violence by their early childhood socialization, the way they're raised, and we're not trained to fight back, we're not trained to feel strong and efficacious. In this project we did, we interviewed women all over the country and were quite startled to find out that most women feel that they are less strong and less fast than other women. didn't surprise us that they felt that they were less capable, less physically efficacious than men, but we were surprised to find how few women felt efficacious physically when they compare themselves with other women. Then further, another aspect of it is that it's almost as if there's a conspiracy to keep women isolated and from sharing these experiences with one another, in that most of us live in individual homes, and until relatively recently, women didn't go to work in large numbers. They didn't have a way to share these kinds of experiences and feelings with one another. And even if they did have an inclination to do that, there were taboos against doing it. And so, I mean, you didn't talk about rape. You didn't talk about wife abuse. You didn't talk about child abuse or sexual child abuse. And if these, you tended much more to keep these a secret. And today, there's a lot more openness about it, even though people still don't tell it to everyone that they know. You don't get help from home in dealing with these issues. You don't get help from the way you're raised. And if you look around, you don't get much help from the institutions in our society. You certainly don't get it from the news media. You certainly don't get it from police or courts or hospitals. And this is beginning to change. There are places, and especially in large cities, where police and hospitals have very sensitive crisis teams now to deal with this kind of violence against women, but still not available everywhere, and it's not expected as a normal way of doing things. And unfortunately, I think it's also true of the church. Women haven't gotten much support from the church on these issues either. People here have told me stories about how little help that they've gotten from their pastors, either because the pastors weren't sensitive to these issues or didn't take them very seriously. I think that another thing that I'd like to share with you at the moment about this is that Holden doesn't escape this. I mean, this is an idyllic place, and I might, from my own perspective, would be a little more idyllic if the sun were out a little more. But it's nonetheless a very beautiful place, and the juxtaposition for me of having agreed with Ingrid in Chicago that I would talk about these issues here has made me very uneasy. It's made me a little angry, and it's made me feel very sad. I probably am most sad about the fact that even women here have been touched by this. I've had several people from here tell me about experiences where that they have had in their lives, and it just makes me realize that there's virtually no place I can go, at least in this country, and get away from it. And I think it is an issue that makes you ask the question, where is God in all this? I have a friend who, learning of the rape of another friend, said, where is God? Was he on vacation? Or was she on vacation? I mean, there, whatever God is, it seems that there ought to be some way of bringing God into the solution of this problem.
Terry.
This glorious to be here. And yet I felt a need, because I think there's a viewpoint that isn't talked about very much, because we all recognize to a certain extent the need for feminist concern to empower women, because white society hasn't done a very good job with that, and that's prodded to it. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the other problem areas, since there aren't very many minorities in this room. There aren't a lot of minorities in the Lutheran Church. There are probably reasons for that. One of the difficulties we've had in the 60s and 70s is that we had a lot of progress made in terms of people of color. To use a term that's frequently used. Getting into positions where we were finally able to talk to teachers, to lawyers, to doctors, to other people, to make them aware of some concerns that we have cross-culturally. When the feminist issues started emerging, suddenly what we found is that it was very difficult for minorities to be placed in positions, because what would happen is that white women would be chosen. Because if you go for affirmative action, a white woman is given the same kind of extra bonus points that a minority is given. And so suddenly, when we had people who were also had experienced certain kinds of discriminations, understandings, we found them replaced by people who came from the same culture, who had the same kind of biases and prejudices, who happened to be of a different gender than the old master. And that was very hard to accept, and something that still hasn't been comfortably dealt with within minority communities, because in terms of the effect, we don't see much difference between the way white women act and the way white men act, at least according to our relationships. Within our own culture, considering various from tribe to tribe, and I can only speak from my own experience, I'm not a woman, obviously. My mom is a tribal council member, family of chief's family, so I grew up in homes that had some kind of authority within our own people, at least. And there was a concern about women having power, that it wasn't all unusual for women to be on the tribal council, for them to direct things. The women primarily had responsibility also in religious activities. So my grandmother was mother of the long house, as my aunt is now, since my grandmother passed away. I think that we probably are at a greater advantage on some levels than people who speak English, because a lot of Indian languages are trapped by the gender classifications that English is. So we don't always have to refer to something as he or she. Our word for God is Yayama. Yai, as I mentioned before, is a suffix regarding legend language or the spiritual. To increase something, you say it more than once, so Yaya. And then Ma is pluralization. So Yaya Ma, the name of the creator, literally means all the spirits, which means the totality of everything. But it has no gender concept. Our word for Indian healer has no gender concept. Or chief, or storyteller. It has no gender classification. And so I don't think that we necessarily have those same kind of restrictions. The one problem we did come into was when the white society came in, because it meant that the roles for the men were almost all native tribes, except to some extent in the agricultural tribes like the Pueblos. The role for men was suddenly removed. That the longer could you hunt, the longer could you conduct religious ceremonies. A lot of things that have been traditionally been the role for men were totally removed and were not permitted by the federal government. Where a lot of the roles that women had always done, the child rearing, nurturing, food preparation, that could continue uninterrupted. And so in the last three or four generations, we're having very strange feedback, where we're getting extremely strong women who are well-educated, who are taking over roles, not only within Indian communities, but in non-Indian communities. That if you were to go on campuses for colleges, you would find a wide difference in terms of the majority of Indian women who are in key positions, who have professorial jobs, professional qualifications, as opposed to the number of Indian men. And so it puts us in an odd position, because it's kind of a mirror image of what goes on with a lot of the white society. That's what I want to share today.
Dot.
My name is Dot Mitterline. I work for Valparaiso University. The theme, gentle justice, is probably a good way to describe my growing involvement in feminist ideas and practices. I'm a TO that used to be called PK, preacher's kid, but now we're referred to as Theological Oxford. My staunchly conservative Missouri Synod father and mother will be amazed when one of these days I have the opportunity to tell them that my growing involvement in feminism grows out of principles that they taught me when I was a child. One of those was because of my name. My given name is Dorothea, and I was told over and over and over again as a child that that meant gift of God. I am a gift of God, and I have gifts from God. My responsibility is to discover and develop my gifts and to use them for others.
A monstrous rat actually ran under your chair. The gift of God ran right to you.
Holy Spirit.
I was encouraged constantly from earliest childhood on by my parents to explore everything. I was never put down because I was a girl. I was not limited in any way because I was a man. And so I had many experiences. I did not have the kind of opportunities that money can buy, but I had many other kinds of encouragement and possibilities opened up to me. I think I grew into a rather strong kind of person, partly because of that. The second principle was you use your gifts for others. And so I was also encouraged constantly to take part in things, not only for my own enjoyment, but for what I could share with others. And if you are the kind of person in our society who is willing to say yes when people ask you to do things, you have marvelous opportunities to do all kinds of things. And so there too, I feel very privileged and fortunate for the kinds of things that came to me because of the encouragement that my parents gave to me. The third principle was, in effect, don't let others set your agenda for you. Follow your own conscience. Be yourself. Don't follow the crowd, et cetera, et cetera. And that became much more complicated because although I didn't face what I would consider discrimination in other areas, there was the one area which was most important in my life, the church, in which I was constrained because I was female. And as a young person trying to find my vocation, I was aware of the fact that I thought that some of my gifts, at least, would fit me for ministry, but that wasn't an option. And so I didn't really seriously consider that at all until later when I began to see how that might have been if I had been born in a different circumstance and different time. But even as a lay person, I was put in a box because of my church. And then as I grew and found other ways to express my gifts and service to others, I encountered more and more women whose experience was similar to mine, but in different areas perhaps. And I began to see that although I had not faced discrimination in education and so, you know, so many other areas, many other women were not as fortunate as I. They had not been valued for being females in their families. They had not been encouraged by their teachers. They had been limited in ways that I had not encountered. But I began to see that there are some patterns of this kind of thing in our society. And so gradually and kind of gently, I began to look for justice in this area. And I am not a radical in any sense of the word. I don't belong to any feminist organizations. I'm not really welcome in many of them because I don't fit the pattern, you know. I like men. I don't see men as oppressors. I'm a sociologist, but I think that people who do oppression are victims of their own social heritage. My political views tend to be conservative. I hope to run for public office someday as a Republican. So I don't, you know, I don't fit the images of feminism that are most widespread in our society. I don't believe in abortion on demand. I believe that fathers should have some say about their potential children, their unborn children, and so on. And yet I am a feminist of a sort, because I find in the feminist movement and in philosophy about feminism, that this is an area of thought and of action which does seek equality of opportunity and potential for everyone. I'm not better than someone else because I'm white and he's black or brown or red. I am not valued more highly than someone who is old or young or handicapped or whatever. At the same time, I am not of less value because he is man and I am woman. And so I've begun to find my voice in teaching and in writing to convey what I feel to be the need for justice, gently perhaps.
I think it's interesting.
15 years older than I am. Stories in your briefs. I tried to think of a joyous story, and I'm sure there are many. But my process with feminism has been that there's been a lot of cognitive dissonance on my part. And by that I mean, I can say I firmly agree with Paul in Galatians that male and female, there is none in Christ. And yet, Ephesians keeps slipping back in somehow. But I am definitely at the point in my life where I do agree with Paul. I do know that I have to confess that I am an oppressor, both probably actively and passively. My hesitancy in the process sometimes comes because I see that those who are on the radical left, at least in my perception, are just as rigid and non-gospel oriented, I think, as those who are on the far right. And I was reminded of this last week at a forum here, and not at a forum, at a Bible study, particularly on the Ephesians text, where someone was advocating one viewpoint and saying that Paul, when he talks about wives being submissive, was correct and feminist. I told the person afterwards, I said, the wolves had gathered and I knew this person was about to be crucified. And I thought later, is this gentle justice? How do we woo this person into the fold? That's where I'm at now in my process with feminism. The anger, I should say, scares me. Maybe that's not correct, but it's where I'm at.
Ingrid.
I'm Ingrid Christiansen. My primary community the last 15 years have been women and men whose values I admire and respect and endorse and aspire to, and those feelings come from me as a Christian. My friends are thoughtful, caring people who have energy for the poor and the dispossessed. And they are people who assume we're all capable and we're all vulnerable and that we're all humane together, that we can all fix refrigerators and we can all grieve deaths and we can all come through for each other. Most of my friends are not Christians. Or if they are, they're some funny version of Christians that don't ever go to church. You must all know people like that. I need the church. I need the church to help me with personal issues, which are thorny, knotty in our society. I need the church to help me think about my choices, the questions I have to face in my life. I want the church to help me think about money, and about abortion, and about death. I need the church. I need help thinking about the big issues in my life. I have found, in the church, in the organized Lutheran church in Chicago, basically, although in Moorhead, Minnesota before that, that when I am there, I feel patronized, I feel diminished, I feel less capable, I feel less like a full person. I find that there's something there for me and for most women I know that makes us hide our talents under a bushel, that makes us less fulfilled. And I think that's not Christian. I think that's wrong. I think that's not biblical to do that to people. So out of that comes a lot of anger, and anger is cyclical, you know, it comes and goes. And there's also a lot of need and a lot of frustration. I'm so grateful for feminist theologians. I'm so grateful for the changing church. I'm so grateful for change. But those are places where I am now.
Well, where are you now? Any comments you would like to make? Any stories you would like to share? Any challenges you would like to share? It's open to any of you. Please raise your hand and then I'll acknowledge. Yes?
I would share an experience. I find personally that my oppressors, so to speak, are not men, but other women. And I find it very frustrating from time to time. And I'm a Presbyterian, and I'm halfway through my undergraduate work at college, and I plan on becoming a pastor. And I've had some opposition, some gentle and some rather violent, to my plans to become a pastor. And I've had my uncles think it's a great idea, but my aunts express their reservations. My dad thinks it's a super idea, but my mom isn't so sure. The people I know at school, it's a Luther College, it's a Luther school. My friends who are men are very supportive of me. They tease me a little bit, but at the same time they're saying more power to you and we're proud of you. But my friends who are women, one actually sat down with me and said, she tried to talk me out of being a pastor because she didn't think it was right for women to do such things. And that really confuses me as to where my support is. If women are supportive of each other, I haven't seen it. And if men are oppressing, I haven't been oppressed by them. And so the situation is not always men in a bad position. Women have always been so wonderful to each other.
Yes.
Well, when my nephew was old enough to walk and understand English, I'd go to visit, and at the end of the visit, I'd say, well, you give me a hug or a kiss? And sometimes he'd say yes, and sometimes he'd say no. And when he said no, I'd say, okay, well, fine, I'll see you next time. And one of his parents would crouch down beside him and whisper in his ear, oh, go on, go on. Give your aunt a hug or a kiss. And I said, don't tell him that. He has autonomy over his own body. And there may come a time when someone asks him to do something with them, or someone tries to force him into something, and he has to be sure that he can say no, that he has control over his body. And it's an issue which isn't really very powerful for, I would say, most adult males, but it's an issue that always stays with women. Here at Holden, there's a lot of time spent telling people here that the wild animals are not cute, that they're to be taken seriously because they could be dangerous, because they are wild, because we have to respect their wildness. And I started to think about what it meant, the word cute, and how it's applied, it's an affectionate term, but it's not an affection with any respect to it. Something that's cute is not threatening, and it's something or someone whose boundaries can be invaded at will. It's made very clear about the animals here, but it's not made so clear about the children or the women here. And the larger issues are discussed, the larger issues of feminism out in the world. But I've seen it here, the forced hug, the gratuitous touching. There was a staff member who's since gone who told me that he was in his 40s, but that most people his age didn't really have the same energy that he did, and so he spent a lot of his time with people who were quite a bit younger. But I didn't notice that he had any problem with men his own age. He just liked to spend a lot of time around young women, and he wasn't really even acknowledging that to himself. I think that a lot of men who might consider themselves feminists are still considering women cute, which is to say that they do not have complete control over what happens to their bodies.
Any reactions from any of you who initially shared to each other that you've seen so far as well?
I'm really saddened to hear what you had to say. I wonder whether it's generational, because I get so much support from women and give support to women, and it's sort of an assumption in my life. I function with it every day in such a regular way and expect it out of my life, and I find it hard to think what's the difference between you and me.
I've thought about that quite a bit too, and there are women who are supportive of me, and I'm supportive of, but they're people I have to make an effort to find. My home environment is more liberal than my school environment, which I think makes a difference. My family is very traditional and fairly conservative, and yet I still wonder. Even my grandfather, both of them actually, they're in their 70s and they're really quite conservative in their own ways, have told me they're very proud of what I plan to do.
Actually, statistically, young women do the best in careers in all sorts of measurable ways if they're encouraged by their fathers early in life.
Yeah.
So that really is, it's borne out in lots of research that's been done on it. I don't know where that comes from either.
And part
my
of
mother
women,
encouraged me.
See themselves and therefore other women, they've been told a woman's place is in the home, especially a lot of women I know at school have been raised in conservative, primarily, but also other Reformed Protestant traditions, that a woman's place is in the home, and a lot of them are at college to catch a husband, so to speak, and they don't see themselves as being capable of responsibility or whatever. I had some women, I think, try really hard to be supportive, and yet in their support they're expressing their doubt. Wow, that sounds like a really tough job. And where I don't think they'd say that to a male person. I don't understand it, but I'm trying to.
Just to add another dimension, and I'm much older than either of the two of you, but I have had the same experience that you have. I have always felt very supported by the opposite sex, and not necessarily told by my own sisters, that part of it I think is very true to my generation of older women. I don't think they knew the camaraderie that women do today. And just to add a further comment, I was recently with a group of women college administrators, and several of us there shared that same feeling that we had always felt support in our career, you know, from the opposite sex. So it's kind of an odd thing that does crop up. And I don't think it's very well explained.
Mm-hmm. Susan? I think one of the things I've noticed, and usually when we generalize, we get ourselves in all kinds of boxes we can't get out of. It's true, not all women are supportive of other women. Not all men are supportive of women, but I likewise have had support groups that have included both men and women. I've been attacked by both men and women in different ways. Men have different ways of attacking than women do, but it hurts just the same. And one thing I've noticed about women, especially mothers, and my mother's been very supportive, and my grandmother's been very supportive, and see some of their own stifled vocational desires being fulfilled in me, which I never knew about until after I was in South America as a missionary for a few years, and later found out after I was practically on the plane that both my mother and my grandmother had wanted to do that, had both gotten married and for other reasons weren't able to do that. That was news to me. But I think a lot of women are very much frightened for their daughters, and especially women who have any idea of what it's like to be different, to be new or first in a field, because you know that a lot of stuff happens. There is a lot, and some of us have been very lucky not to have a lot of overt oppression or overt attacks on us. And whenever I feel that I've been very lucky that way, I always say a few extra prayers of thanksgiving for the women who've come before me, who've gone through brick walls that, you know, would have killed me probably, and a lot of other women I know. So in that sense, instead of saying I'm not like those women who have been attacked as, oh, they were very militant, they were very aggressive, they were very unladylike, at first I say, well, I'm just different, you know, I'm not like them. And I can still say I'm not like them, but thank goodness they were like they were, or I wouldn't be here today. And so I think there's something about that. Also, when you're first, you get a lot of weird comments. And I can work very hard, just as I used to do with exclusive language to include myself, I now can work very hard to make something that sounds offensive seem really flattering. And you know, it's really important to do that. And part of it, especially from women, I was at a home once preaching, and a lot of elderly women there. One woman came up to me and said, you're the first woman pastor I've ever met, and you were good. And then she listened to herself and she said, now why am I saying that to you? Because you're a woman, you can't be good. Of course you can be good. You know, right before my eyes, she was going through this whole process in her head of confronting her own sexism. She had been trained to think that women wouldn't be as good as men, and when she found one that seemed to be as good as a man, she felt she had to comment on it, and then felt bad that she had to do that. And another comment I've had from women, too, a woman came up to me and said, how could you get up there and preach and look so confident? How can you do that? I wouldn't be able to do that. And I thought, I'm not all that confident when I get up there. And of course she could do that in other circumstances. But what I interpreted in that, I knew she wouldn't say that to a man. That's not a comment. And the pastors, I bet we could pull the male pastors here. I don't know how many women would go up to them on a Sunday and say, I don't know how you get up there and preach every Sunday. It must be awfully difficult. They expect the male pastor to do that. But what I heard in that woman was projecting herself in my place and thinking, you know, I'm a woman, I could be there, but no, I couldn't do that. But it was a step towards acknowledging the fact that, yes, she too could be there. She didn't feel equipped at that moment, but I don't always feel equipped now either. But there was that identification, and so instead of feeling put down because I was a woman, she was saying, why aren't you, you know, looking confident? For a woman, I felt good about her own sense of herself in that moment.
Here and then up here.
I think that something needs to be said for those of us who have never felt put down. I have always been able to do whatever I wanted to do within reason, of course. My father also thinks that way, and yet I was the good math student. I was the one who could take the clocks apart and put them together, not my brother. And I was encouraged to do those kinds of things. And But I want, what I wanted to say was, when a woman does choose to be a mother, I think it's important for us to realize that that woman ought to be that mother. I can remember coming home from school and having no one home, and having to cook dinner for my brothers and sisters. And I can remember coming home from school when I lived with my grandmother and having dinner ready for me and someone to talk to. And there's a difference. And I think kids need that. I think they need that nurturing. I was fortunate to be able to have both. Some kids are fortunate, unfortunate, to just have nothing in a mother. And I think if a mother's going to be a mother, then she ought to take on the responsibility with, I don't know what I want to say. But I think some mothers, and I think it's all right for people to be mothers who can't do these kinds of things, like be there when their kid comes home from school. And that's just one example. There are some people who can't do that, but I think it's all right for them to be mothers. But I think that it's their responsibility to see that there is somebody there, like my grandmother, or a babysitter, or somebody, even when a child is in the 10th grade, as I was, when my grandmother was there, would suffer ready for me, when I knew how to do it, and had done it for years. Did I make myself anywhere near clear?
Up here, and then over here.
We've got another story. It's not a, an encouraging one either, but when my home congregation was looking for a pastor 2 years ago, the pastor nominating committee was made up of both men and women, primarily in their 30s. And my father was part of this committee, and he said, we actually ended up hiring two pastors because that was determined best for the church at the time. And they both happened to be women. And my dad said, we picked the two best candidates who were clearly superior to any of the men who applied. He said, and the people, some of the people expressed reservation. This was told at the dinner table with my mother, my two sisters and I. And we joined in with this big feminist outrage chorus, all those terrible men. My dad said, no, it was the women who objected. And the men thought we should go ahead and do it. And we felt a little embarrassed, of course, but we tried to figure out why. And my dad, they were raising a lot of questions as to whether the women would be capable as pastors. And my mother had the insight that maybe they felt that they couldn't do those things, so they thought all women can do those things.
I just would like to respond that my husband and I share a job between us. We had two full-time jobs, and then when we had a baby, we cut back to one job and divided it in half. And we lived on half as much money, but had the joy of parenting our children together, and have parented our children for 10 years together, and shared the job, and shared the children, and shared the housework, and shared all that stuff. And it's dying and going to heaven, as far as I'm concerned. It's a wonderful way to live. But I don't think that deciding to be a parent is deciding to be, I don't think it's just a mother's decision. I think it's a, takes two to tango, and once you've done it, if you've been co-parent, it's much nicer for everyone. It's nicer for the kids, and it's nicer for the parents. It's nice for me to have my husband say to me, have you noticed that Katie seems a little out of sorts? What do you think the problem is? It could be this, this, or this. You know, to have someone else observing my children and tuned into them and loving them and nourishing them. And so that I have another adult that I reflect. No, you know, no one loves your kids like you do. I mean, your friends and their teachers and their chums' parents don't know them as well as their own parents know them. But to have two parents who know them very well and intimately and can reflect on their development and growth is marvelous.
And I think the father can can love a parent or a loved child even though he's not there for 8 hours in the day. He can come home and spend quality time with that child.
But wouldn't it be nice if our society worked harder at providing
more time
for parents to parent? Mm-hmm. I mean, to let everyone who wanted to work less earn, for example, if you're working two-thirds, to earn two-thirds of full-time pay, choose to live on less money, to pare down and simplify, and parent for the joy of it.
And not have to come home after your day of work and clean the house and cook.
And just be exhausted and have the worst time left over for your family.
And still a paper.
But I think if more people, at least among my friends, did decide to live on less money, there would be more options for them to parent. Or if they push the institutions real hard that they work for to be more flexible. Our institution did not like the idea of us doing this. But we both worked for the same institution, and we forced them in a way, we really persuaded them that it would be okay. And they said, well, we'll have to lie to the insurance company because the insurance company won't insure you if you're part-time. And we said, fine, so say that only one of us is working, you know, but that person's working full-time. And they said, but that'll be a lie. I mean, Andy, you'd love that. They adjusted the whole thing about the description of what we were doing to fit their systems. And then we insisted on changing the person who was working full-time every year so that 1 year it would be me and the next year it would be Johnny. Drove them crazy. But we said, well, we have to have a work record. It's a proof that we've worked all this time. And why shouldn't we shift it back and forth? It works. I mean, you know, they said, well, I guess I can't think of any reason.
Do you think that's possible for everybody?
No, but I think that everyone can push a little harder at their institution, and we can gradually change our society.
Is there a question up here? Were you great? No? Okay. Who's that?
I think a lot of institutions are working harder to do that. I think one example, my mother works for Western Life Insurance Company, and it's a very large firm, a lot of people, and they're considering making an institute, a daycare center within the building. And a lot of single mothers work at Western Life, and that it's not a big thing, but it's a step in the direction of saying we realize it's hard for women and men to find responsible daycare for their children, and we're providing it. And churches also in doing like providing responsible daycare, and I think that's important too, if both parents can, or if there is only one parent who has to work full time, and that's something institutions are doing.
Betty Friedan, in a recent article, is afraid that what last generation, however you want to define that, the last 10, 20 years of hard work in achieving some of those goals, that now current people of, let's say, 18 to 25-year-old are taking for granted, and younger, will be lost because they're not really a part of the fragment of society that once we stop pushing, there will be a retreat. And somehow she says that we need to once again raise the consciousness of all people and not just assume that these privileged.
Taken aback by that. It seems like there's so much fun to be had in this whole notion of more freedom for everyone. And it's great for men to be able to be more in touch with their feminine side, if there is such a thing, for men to be free to express more feelings and not have to be the tough guy on the beach, you know, or the sort of macho. I mean, I think it's a wonderful idea for everyone to be able to be a freestanding person, self-sustaining during most of their life, but to go through real weak periods where you depend on someone else. You know, I want to be able to do that, but I want my husband to be able to do that too. And he does, and I do. So then we can each go through weak and strong times in our life, and we don't always have to have our acts perfectly together. But it's a lot more fun this way, because we're freer to sort of come and go and be what we are and stuff. And also, the stuff that women do together is so full of joy and energy and delight that it's hard to think that there's something wrong about that. When women enjoy one another and support one another and really laugh together and sing and play and have fun and work. And so it's not, and I don't think we're talking about a real grim sort of joyless proposition here. It's not hammering this thing home. I mean, I think anger is, and it should be expressed. But I don't think any anger is any different than a foot or a nose. You know, it's just a thing. It's just there, and you do it, you get rid of it, and then you go on to the next thing. And then you have some fun.
Here and here.
I think it's a sad conversation to me because as I struggle with who I am in Christ and I realize that I must be a servant to my fellow man, the conversation here is all self-serving. And that's a struggle for me because if I struggle and fight to beat down all of the oppressions that people seem to be doing to me, then I'm looking at myself rather than what Christ has called us to be, and that is a servant. Because if I'm a servant to someone, I really can't be oppressed. That may be true and may not be true.
Well, I was going to say something else, and I want to respond to that. The first thing I want to say is in connection with Ingrid's statement about, you know, the joy involved. And I'm the executive director for a women's volunteer organization. We have a couple of national meetings every year. And the one thing that comes through over and over and over again by people who come to these meetings is, wow, what fantastic people these are who are running this organization, you know, the officers and those who are in charge of various aspects of the organization. The fact that women have all of these abilities and creativity and so on, and a place in which to express themselves is really a wonderful experience for other women who haven't seen their sisters take these kinds of roles. But there's more and more of that happening today, I think, that women are able to express what's really themselves. It seems to me that part of the difficulty now is relating to my own experience. In a sense, I have to say to the church, look, here's me. Here's someone with certain kinds of gifts that you can make use of. You need me. You know? And it shouldn't be up to me to have to say that. And I think that's where women are right now. We're having to take that role of putting ourselves forward. And it looks very self-serving, even when our intention is not to be self-serving. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I'd like to say it just on both sides, men and women. I think we're both having to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. What church is it that you go to that doesn't let women do what they want to do? I don't understand that. I've never experienced
it. I'm the first woman president of my congregation. It's a congregation of 3,000 members, has $1 million budget, and so on. There are very many people who are very wary about letting a woman have this kind of responsibility. No, but the first, okay? But anything having to do with the worship life of the congregation, no. They're very clearly defined.
There were women pastors when I was a kid.
My church, they were.
Yeah.
We're talking Missouri.
Yeah.
To define.
That's a different church.
I would like to honor the time commitment, but also to say to you that if you want to continue the discussion, feel free to, but those who must leave can leave. But I just have to say one thing first. The joy of what the women's movement or the feminist movement has given me is the challenge that we as men need to get to know each other like I think women are attempting to get to know each other. I think we need men's support groups, men's consciousness raising groups and so forth, because I, like you, enjoy women in almost more in conversation than men.